Heading to CBC? Make sure to stop by booth 1989 to chat with the Brewbound team, check out our live podcast recordings, and find out about Brewbound's upcoming events. Have news to submit ahead of the show? Head to brewbound.com/submitnews to let us know about your latest updates.
4 years later, Stone and Molson Coors' trademark fight finally makes it to trial. We're going to talk about it on the Brewbound Podcast. Hey, yo, welcome to the Brewbound Podcast. My name is Justin Kendall, and I'm the editor of Brewbound. And I'm joined by Jess Infante, the managing editor of Brewbound, who is on the road in a hotel room somewhere in D.C.
I am in Arlington, Virginia.
Oh, close enough.
Close enough. At the Ritz-Carlton. Really wow. Fancy. Yeah, NAFCA conference. Pulls no punches.
Man, we don't get to stay at Ritz's. Also joining us, and not from a Ritz, is Zoe Licata, Brewbound's reporter extraordinaire, Generation Z correspondent, and hard Mountain Dew aficionado still. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Not as great as if I was in a Ritz, but it's all right.
You win some, you lose some.
Yeah, exactly. So this week, we mentioned it in the cold open, and we're going to have a guest here, Brendan Palfreyman, a partner with Harris Beach. He's the guy you always see on beer Twitter, tweeting about copyright and trademark lawsuits. And we're going to chat with him about the Stone versus Molson Coors case that is finally at trial. We've had Gavin Hattersley from Molson Coors on the stand. We've had Greg Cook on the stand. So a lot to cover there. But let's get started with a bit of news this week. And we're going to start off with something I teased last week, which is the open source collaboration beer Resolve to benefit the humanitarian effort in Ukraine. That was launched last week by 42 North. That's a New York craft brewery. John Simperman from there reached out, told us about that project, and they're partnering with 2085 Brewery in Ukraine. That was started by Naz Drabont. He's one of the co-founders there, and he helped start 42 North in its early years. And John mentioned to me, you know, Naz is now in Ukraine. He's on the front lines there, it sounds like. And they wanted to work out something because John said, you know, this is one of our own and we felt helpless, you know, and you've got the Russian invasion going on in Ukraine, just these horror shows playing out on 24-hour news networks that we're all watching here in the U.S. And he's right. You can't help but feel helpless when you see the scenes there. Somebody wrote to us last week and, you know, took issue with our term conflict, and that was the wrong word choice. This is unjustified aggression. This is war that's been declared on Ukraine by Russia, and it's heartbreaking. So John and 42 North are asking craft brewers in the U.S. and around the globe to join in on this open source collaboration beer effort and donate the proceeds to, I believe it's Global Empowerment Mission. That's what's going on there. And if you want to find out more about that, go to resolveukrainebeer.com.
That email that you mentioned was super polite, and I really appreciated receiving it because we're not geopolitical experts. We're beer business journalists, so we're not going to be perfect, but it was really, really helpful information.
Right. You know, word choice is so important, and we try and be careful, but every now and again, you know, something's going to come out of my mouth because I'm not the most eloquent speaker. I didn't go to school for podcasting, but, you know,
does anybody?
Somehow you end up on one.
Exactly. Yeah, we're all writers. I mean, I wonder if there are like podcast majors now at journalism schools.
There must be something now, I feel like. If you can major in NFTs now, I guess you can major in podcasting too.
Oh, no. Can you major in NFTs?
Podcasting 101 was not offered at Iowa State University in 1999, unfortunately, but yes, go to resolveukrainebeer.com. Check that out. If you want to participate, all the info is there. And let's get to some more of the news out there. And Surly is looking to expand. We're going to be spending some time in Minneapolis for the Craft Brewers Conference. And Jess, you got to talk with Bill Manley at Surly about what they're up to.
I did. Yeah, I had a nice chat with Bill a couple of weeks back. Bill is vice president of marketing. He'll be moving into a newly created role, vice president of brand development, where he'll be more focused on innovation. But they are looking to open another brewery, location TBD, potentially Ohio or Michigan. And they're not currently in Ohio, so that would be a new market for them. In addition to that, expansion into Ohio and Indiana is on the list for this year. But we had a really nice talk. You know, what's interesting to me is that Sirley's, like you said, based in Minneapolis, and Minnesota is the country's last 3-2 state. So a lot of beer can't be sold at grocery and C-store. And I think, you know, by nature of that, chains hadn't really been as much of a thing for them. But Bill told me that they recently hired a national accounts manager who's been able to form these relationships with these chain, you know, grocery and C-stores. And that's really helped them accelerate that part of their business. So while they're not trying to expand too far beyond their current footprint, they are looking to go deeper in those markets through these chain relationships. You know, we did talk a little bit about they had come to Massachusetts just before COVID. They did a bit of a test run with Brew Pipeline and the guest brewer program that lets you sign on to, you know, get distributed in new markets. And I guess the test run had gone so well that they wanted to make things permanent. But, you know, like the timing of that was just really rough. And I think they ended up, you know, leaving Mass. But what they learned from that is that it's really hard to resonate with consumers the farther away you get from your home market. So they're really looking to become like a Midwest powerhouse.
Yeah, I remember in the mid-2010s, Surly sort of had one of those, well, I was in the Midwest at that time. I was living in Kansas City, and Surly had one of those reputations as, ooh, you know, Surly, you know, I want to try Surly, you know, get furious or, you know, Todd the Axeman, all those beers. But, you know, it's been a few years and, you know, craft went through this ebb and flow of popularity. And it's more evident, I think, than ever that the home market strategy is the strongest strategy at this point for some of these regionals.
For sure. And I'm sure a lot more breweries have popped up in the years since, you know, you just talked about. Interesting to me was that in 2020 and even until last year, Furious had a double-digit boost. 12 packs of Furious last year kind of took off of them. We're up 14%. So that does kind of bear out the thinking that, you know, during the pandemic, people were really turning to tried and true flagship brands. We talked a little bit about their on-premise situation and, you know, they're down about 20,000 barrels and 16,000 of those Bill attributed to the on-premise. And a lot of that is some accounts that are just closed and gone forever. The next year, I think, is really going to be a rough ride for a lot of people whose portfolios lean more draft.
Yeah. Let's skip down our U.S. map a little bit to Des Moines, Iowa. And Exile Brewing Company is adding a side hustle, Exile Beverage Company. And they're starting with a line of vodka sodas. I talked to Nick Servine, their sales manager, and he told me that they want to be on sort of the cutting edge of what's going on in the Iowa beer scene or Bev Alk scene, really. And they're hopeful that RTD canned cocktails is one way to get there. And it's a lot of like building a portfolio for the future. So if the future, if beer isn't doing it for you, and that's not to say their beer business isn't, because they're doing a good beer business in Iowa. I think they're maybe the second largest craft brewer in the state, second or third, right behind Toppling Goliath.
That RTD expansion, that seems to be what the people want. So it makes sense to add something like that to your portfolio. You know, I know we talked about how I'm at the Ritz-Carlton in Pentagon City, but I'm here for a conference. The National Alcoholic Beverage Control Association kindly invited me to attend their conference, but there's been a lot of the attendees are in more of like the wine and spirits part of the world, and a lot of talk about spirits-based RTDs yesterday. And they seemed, you know, I think a question had come up during a panel from an audience member who was like, are breweries acquiring spirits producers to do this? And the answer to that is no, they're just doing it on their own, just like, you know, Exile is.
Exactly. They're partnering with somebody local on the spirits. I think that's what Juneshine's doing as well. They're sourcing their spirits products and doing the mixing at Scripps Ranch in San Diego. Another story that we covered, more expansion, Three Notched in Charlottesville, Virginia, has acquired the former Wild Wolf Brewing Company production facility and its 18 acres of land in Nellisford, Virginia. And that's going to be also to get into some distilling. It's the story that we're seeing more and more of this year is, you know, portfolio expansion. And I spoke with CEO George Kastendike, and he told me that there's some work that they need to do on this facility, but it's going to give them a lot of production run room to grow. And they've also brought on the former director of marketing for Bolivar Brewing Company, Natalie Gershon, to be their chief growth officer. And so they are going hard at spirits. They're going hard at non-alcoholic beer. Those are going to be two of the growth areas they go after. And as far as their beer portfolio, they used to self-distribute. And I think it was a few years back, he said they sold their distribution rights to Blue Ridge Beverage. And that partnership has really took them to another level. And last December, they sold the remaining rights in the state to the Reyes Beer Division. And they think that that's really going to open up chain and convenience for them. So another growth story out there.
It just makes sense, especially, you know, self-distro is hard work. And sometimes a partner can help you do it better.
Well, we saw that with Night Shift Distributing. They chose to go with Shein, and they're hoping to accelerate through that network.
We sure did. We were in DC when we found out that news. Look at this. Full circle.
Coming full circle, yes. Also, up on the site, I spoke with Dave Nosby, the brand manager for Voodoo Ranger. They've launched Juice Force, a 9.5% hazy Imperial IPA. It's going gangbusters already in 19.2-ounce single-serve cans. So much so that before they've even spent $1 of media investment on it, they've, I think, surpassed 15,000 barrels already. They had targeted 50,000 barrels for the year, and now they're projecting 70,000 barrels in year one. That would make it a top 3 to 4 Voodoo Ranger brand and the biggest launch in Voodoo Ranger history.
Wow. I mean, that's massive. It's interesting that they've really just kind of like come into and dominated the convenience store channel.
Yeah, we talk about that dichotomy between low and no products. And then on the other end, you have hazy and imperial being the two craft growth styles. So they found the sweet spot with a hazy imperial. And I mean, there are other products out there, but none really with the national reach. I'm not sure that Big Little Thing from Sierra Nevada fits that. I don't think that it's a hazy, but maybe. So yeah, they're taking their Venn diagram of what's popular and going next level with it. Zoe, would you drink a 19.2-ounce double IPA?
I don't think it would be my go-to reach. Maybe if I needed a beer and there wasn't a lot of other options there, there's no way I'm finishing that though. That is a lot in one can.
Right? Like I would be on the floor.
That's the one thing that surprises me is the high ABV 19.2-ounce being the thing that's sort of taken off, but I guess you get the bang for your buck.
That's the type of beer too that like I would have to drink it slowly. And so by the time I got to like the last third of the can, it would probably be a little warm and I don't know if I could finish that.
Who wants that?
No one.
Finally, we have some St. Patrick's Day survey data from Numerator, and more than half of U.S. consumers plan to celebrate St. Patrick's Day this year, 56%. Although I'm going to guess that where we live in Boston, it's around 99%, somewhere in there.
I'd say that's accurate.
At least if you're from here, maybe more so.
Definitely. I think it's like a sin if you don't celebrate.
Well, thanks for the judgment already on my non-celebration.
Just if you were born and raised here, then it is. So you don't count. You're off the hook.
Do you plan to celebrate, Zoe?
Yes. Hopefully the weather will be all right because we are getting back into darty season. So I think it might rain a little bit, might move inside, but there will be some St. Patrick's Day festivities.
I actually, Zoe, have been meaning to tell you that we have an invitation to hang out with the one and only Don Bixel Jr. on Thursday.
Oh, yes.
But you might be busy with the youth.
We will be doing all of our celebrating during the weekend. So on the actual St. Patrick's Day, I'll be a responsible adult and not going too crazy with my friends.
Will you, or are you going to meet me and Don?
I was going to say, if Don's here, then maybe I can't really, my responsibilities might go out the window. Yeah.
Am I going to see either of you on Friday?
Are we doing something on Friday?
You know, working.
Oh,
oh yeah, we'll be fine.
Yeah. Yes. We can bring it back together. We can handle it.
Well, that puts Zoe and Jess in the 1/3 of celebrators who say they plan to gather with friends or family on St. Patrick's Day. Nearly half of those celebrators, 46%, say they will purchase alcoholic beverages for St. Patrick's Day. That seems super low to me for those who are celebrating.
I mean, maybe the rest are just moochers and are going to drink everybody else's.
Maybe, yeah. But they did not ask this question, but I'm guessing around 99% of those people are going to be drinking a Guinness at some point as well.
It's interesting to me that that number is only a couple points lower than Labor Day and Memorial Day for who is going to be purchasing alcohol. It seems like a much more alcohol-forward holiday.
Well, a lot of us have to work, I guess, so maybe that's what's holding people back. But this year, you have the confluence of St. Patrick's Day taking place on the first day of the NCAA tournament, Go Cyclones, and that's a holiday unto itself. So you get two holidays in one. I'm going to say that we're going to get some great beer sales this week.
Yeah, I feel like this is shaping up to be the shot in the arm I think we needed. And by we, I mean the beer industry.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it is a bold prediction.
A very bold prediction.
But we'll see. Guys, I just found out that we are apparently Irish, which was news to me. One of my brothers just did a 23andMe, I know, right? And revealed some ancestry from Ireland.
Is this going to set up like a trip to meet a long-lost cousin or family member?
Maybe. I don't know. I'd love to go. My husband studied abroad in Ireland for a whole... He told his parents that he wanted to go someplace where they drank a lot and spoke English. And they were like, well, sounds like you want to visit the Syracuse University Ireland extension. But yeah, I always felt slightly left out on St. Patrick's Day, you know, because they say everybody's Irish on St. Patrick's Day. But I, you know, always felt like a little, you know, like I didn't belong. But I can celebrate in earnest this year. Now I'm in. With that teeny little 3% or whatever it is.
With that, I think we should get to our featured interview.
Malt Europe Malting Company is North American proud with premium grains from field to flavor. Our selections include base, specialty, and distillers malt varieties. Stop by our booth 2143 at the Craft Brewers Conference in Vegas. Does your brewing software suck? We've heard it from thousands of brewers. Connect with Ollie today and we'll buy out your current contract and hook you up with brewing software that doesn't suck. Visit booth 1685 at CBC or hit getollie.com/pod.
All right, joining us now is Brendan Palfreyman, a partner with Harris Beach. He's the guy who tweets all about the copyright and trademark lawsuits on beer Twitter, including Stone versus Molson Coors. You can find him at B_Palfreyman on Twitter. Brendan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
Yeah, we're stoked to have you. And so, like us, I'm sure you've been following the coverage on Courthouse News Service, which is surprisingly one of the only outlets that's really providing daily coverage of the Stone Molson Coors case in San Diego. And so we've seen like probably 4 or 5 reports already from them. We've got testimony from Molson Coors CEO Gavin Hattersley. We've got testimony from Stone co-founder Greg Cook. As you're following along this coverage, as someone who has been involved in these type of cases before, what are you listening for? What are you watching for?
I'm watching to try and learn what I can about the parties' respective strategies, what they're trying to impress upon the jury, impress upon the court. From what I can glean so far, and I haven't seen the transcripts yet, of course, I will eventually, but Molson Coors is leaning heavily into the demographic difference between the customers of, say, an Arrogant Bastard and Keystone Light. Obviously, they're offered to consumers at completely different price points. They're often purchased by consumers in different settings. A lot of C-store and grocery store purchases for Keystone and, you know, your Keystone Brewing drinkers are, you know, going to be drinking this up at restaurants, bars, beer stores, but, you know, grocery stores to some extent as well. Probably not gas stations as much. Molson Coors' attorney and their CEO are really driving home the point that people know enough about these two products that they're not going to walk into a store and basically that they're educated enough to know the difference between the two types of beer despite similarities in the name, you know, especially, you know, since the branding has switched. So the hallmark of any trademark infringement case is likelihood of confusion. That's, you have to prove that consumers are likely to be confused between the two products. And there's a whole series of factors that go into that test, which in California is called the Sleek Craft test, one of which is actual confusion. And that seems to be so far what, at least from the reports that we've seen, that Stone is focusing on. Actual confusion, consumers being confused either initially or throughout the entire process as to with what company Keystone is affiliated with. So far, though, those seem to be the two things that they've focused on. This trial will probably go on for around 2 weeks. So we'll see that shift. At some point, we'll see Stone switch to damages. So right now, they're trying to establish a liability that there is in the first place. But at some point, they'll have to use their allotted time, which they have 33 hours to, you know, show that they've been harmed.
Cool. Now, how difficult is it going to be for Stone to prove that consumers were confused? I know, you know, like if you look at Bianca Bruno's coverage, you'll see some references to, you know, Greg mentioned in his testimony, he saw people on Reddit being just confused or thinking that they saw a billboard and thinking it was Stone's, but it was really Keystone. Like, what is the burden of proof here and how difficult is this going to be for them?
The burden of proof in pretty much any civil case is a preponderance of the evidence, which just means 51% or, you know, the scale just tips slightly more likely than not. So it's not an incredibly high burden, especially when you think about things like beyond a reasonable doubt or clear and convincing evidence. These are very hard standards to prove. They just have to convince the jury that it's more likely than not that there is a likelihood of confusion. And it's theoretical. So they'll have expert witnesses testifying about that. No experts, so far we only have fact witnesses, I believe, but eventually there'll be expert witnesses for both sides testifying that, you know, based on Stone's long-running use, that there is a likelihood of confusion here. And then they'll try to buttress that with the things like Reddit threads and emails, you know, mistakenly sent by consumers to one company or the other. Oftentimes, actual confusion can be tough to get your hands on, and it can be tough to get in admissible form, as you mentioned. So a Reddit thread may very well not be admissible. You can use it for purposes other than the ultimate truth of what you're trying to establish, but it can be difficult. So that's why actual confusion isn't a requisite. You don't have to have actual confusion evidence. So it shows that consumers are likely to be confused. But if you have actual confusion, that's the best evidence there is that people are likely to be confused because they were actually confused. Experts will also use survey evidence. So they'll conduct a survey by, you know, calling or sending out an internet survey, you know, giving people hypotheticals and saying, you know, would you believe these two companies are, or these two products are produced by the same company? And Molson Coors will attack those surveys, attack Stone's expert. They could put on their own surveys, counter surveys. It's fascinating because it never gets this far. This is the Super Bowl for me. This is the biggest, I think, craft beer lawsuit in like the last 50 years, probably. And that encompasses all of craft beer. So it's probably the biggest craft beer lawsuit of all time. We almost had a good one with, I think it was Lagunitas and Sierra Nevada back in the day. But that lawsuit lasted less than 24 hours. This stuff never gets this far. But both sides are pot committed. So we'll actually, odds are, it could settle. You know, sometimes these cases settle on the verge of a jury verdict, but this one I think is going to go to the nine citizens of California who are going to decide this thing.
What is it about this particular suit that has made it like go further than most usually do? And like, is there a percentage you can think of, like how often they actually are going to trial?
It's Greg Cook's sheer will.
Yeah. Well, it's two things. I think it's the stakes and it's that both sides are well-funded. So this lawsuit is costing each side, you know, into the multiple six figures for sure. And I'm sure Molson Coors is probably paying more because they have excellent and expensive attorneys working for them. But both sides are funded, so they have the money to see this through. And the stakes are extremely high. One is, you know, Stone did a whole press rollout sort of when this lawsuit was filed. You know, they have to show they're serious and they haven't blanched. Sometimes you'll see parties reaching for settlement or accommodation, and I haven't seen that from either side in this case. And Keystone and Molson Coors obviously can't give because what's being asked of them is to rebrand one of their core beers. Are you going to change the name of Keystone Light, Coors Light? You know, these are immutable names that aren't going to change absent a court order. So I think that's why. And as far as a percentage, you'll see numbers thrown around, but it's somewhere in the high 90s, like very high 90s, cases that actually go to a verdict. Some cases will wrap up earlier, like motion for summary judgment. Those are very frequent. And sometimes those dispose of a case before it gets to the trial stage. But as far as a case that actually gets to a jury verdict, it's got to be 99% of cases don't get that far.
Wow. So we're looking at something super rare.
Extremely, yeah.
So Stone, you know, has a history of really defending their mark. And sometimes people don't quite understand the process and they just think Stone is being litigious. But what I'm trying to say here is that Stone had to do all of those little things against, you know, tinier breweries so that they have a leg to stand on in court when the second largest beer maker in the country is using their name too, correct?
Yes. I imagine it's all part of the same strategy because there's no law. Like you'll often hear it's incumbent upon trademark owners to enforce their marks. It's sort of just something people say. There's no law out there that says that. There's no hard and fast rule. You have to do it every time. But the idea is that if you don't enforce your mark, there's going to be tons of third-party use out there, and it makes your mark weak. So if there are a billion stones brewing out there, Molson Coors, that'd be one of the first thing they would point to. So I imagine it's all part of the same strategy. And most of the time, it's in the trademark opposition context that they're asserting these claims. So if someone files for a trademark for Wood and Stone Brewing Company or something like that, and they will oppose that trademark. They do that. I see at least 12 to 20 of those a year at this point.
From Stone alone?
Yeah.
Wow.
And that's part of this strategy of this lawsuit, I imagine. I don't have historical data, but my guess would be that their trademark opposition efforts ramped up substantially 3 years ago when this lawsuit was filed and in the lead up to that lawsuit.
Shifting gears a little bit, I want to get to some of the testimony and arguments from Molson Coors, and some of what came out of there, maybe it shouldn't be surprising, but they sort of have to open up about who the Keystone Light consumer is. And what came out of that is more than half of Keystone Light consumers do not work, and a quarter of its consumers earn less than $30,000 annually. And that struck me as, well, how many of those are college kids versus unemployed individuals? I don't know. But, if I remember college days, it's a lot of Natty Light and Keystone Light. You know, that's what you would see at parties because it's cheap.
How well do you remember them?
I don't remember them that well. Definitely not that well, thankfully. But one of the arguments that Gavin Hattersley made, Molson Coors CEO on the stand, was it would make no sense for an economy brand to masquerade as a higher priced craft beer brand. The Keystone Light, the Natural Light drinkers that I know, if they took a drink of an IPA thinking it was a Keystone Light, they would spit take it. Like, there's no way that they would drink it. They would think that there's something wrong with it. And I'm sure we all sort of know people like that. So I'm trying to put it together in my head how it would make sense from Molson Coors' perspective to pretend that it's a higher priced offering.
Maybe it doesn't. I mean, that's a solid argument that they've got. On the other hand, like, what's the alternative? Like, would they associate themselves with just low quality beer? I mean, it doesn't hurt a brand to give, especially if you don't have to invest the time and the money and the ingredients to actually make your product better. It certainly doesn't help to improve the quality conception that consumers have with a branding refresh. I can see where Molson Coors is coming from, but at the same time, if there's a way to make, and it's rational, right? If there's a way to make your product seem, you know, higher quality, or at least of a higher quality in comparison to its peers, like this is higher quality than Natty or whatever else there might be out there, then that also makes rational sense, I think, as well. There's motivations in either direction.
Right. And they argued that a lot of the turnaround of that brand with that refresh was due to essentially giving away three beers. They took their 12 packs from 12 pack, they added three cans, made it a 15 pack. And so, you know, you get into this lower price, more for less, I guess.
Yeah. Molson Coors is going to do everything they can to show that their rebound, their increase in sales was due to something other than a focus on the word Stone. I don't know if it's come out yet in trial. It probably has a little bit, but Stone will certainly rely on internal documents from Molson Coors talking about things like own the Stone. Like that was, I think that was part of the name of like their campaign internally at Molson Coors to, which at least gives the impression that they're focusing more on the word Stone as opposed to the original name Keystone, which Molson Coors has its own trademark for. There's no argument that could be used against Keystone, which I think predates Stone as a company.
It's worth mentioning that Keystone Light and Molson Coors haven't relented in that advertising or in those campaigns, even with this lawsuit going on. You could go to the Keystone Light website and right there, they might as well have the picture of Greg Cook holding the Keystone Light can that focuses on Stone, because that's exactly, that's the iconic image that comes out of this trial, or at least in craft beer. You know, like we need an NFT of that, I think. There you go, Stone. Recoup some of those legal fees.
Yeah, and that's what I meant with the stakes are so high. Like no one's given in here. And what's going to be fascinating is someone has to win. And damages in the trademark context can be difficult to prove. So there are a couple scenarios. One, on the ultimate question of whether or not they can continue using at least this brand formulation, Stone could win or Molson Coors could win. One level after that is if Stone wins, will they get any damages? They could win and get zero damages. That's totally possible. In which case, that's going to be a bit of a bitter pill to swallow, given how much they've likely sunk into this case already. Or they could get a small amount, a nominal amount of damages, you know, like, or they could get everything they're hoping for. Who knows?
And with what they've said that they've lost, you know, they claim that their sales have declined 20% since 2017 when this rebrand went down, and that's to the tune of around $174 million. So what you're saying here is, you know, they could get nothing. They could get some damages. You know, is there a cap on the level of damages in the state of California that they can recoup from something like this?
No. I mean, there's the ceiling of what they've asked for. So the jury's unlikely to go beyond that. Although, as a plaintiff's attorney, there are the cases every once in a while where you get the question from the jury, like, are we allowed to give more than you asked for? It always, you know, makes one side's heart stop, the other side's heart flutter. But no, there's no ceiling on what they could recover.
Who would be an ideal juror in this situation? Like if I'm Stone, who do I want to see in the jury box?
Probably a craft beer drinker.
How much expelling of bearded white men happened during jury selection? Nope. 18's out.
I think yesterday maybe was the 30th anniversary of my cousin Benny. So a lot of people have to probably rewatch that recently or familiar or refamiliarize himself with the concept of voir dire, which is you go through and you ask the jury questions about their background and try to, you know, get some hint as to how they might rule. And each side gets a certain amount of peremptory challenges where you can just strike jurors for whatever reason you feel like. And then other jurors can be excused for cause if they're biased for some reason, or they're, you know, going to be like giving birth like around this time or something like that. You know, like there are plenty of reasons jurors can be stricken from the pool. And here, it would have been fascinating to be a fly in the wall during that process to find out. I'm sure the questions are, what kind of beer do you drink? How often do you drink beer? Have you ever been to Stone? Have you ever tried Keystone? What did you drink in college? What do you drink now?
Do you know how to swirl a glass?
Yeah.
Imagine questions you could try and tease out who's a beer nerd and who's not. What does BJCP stand for? If they know, go on.
So who would Molson Coors want to see? Just casual consumers?
Probably consumers of their product, like blue collar, probably lower income folks who aren't even aware of the craft beer world of what we're talking about here, I would guess.
It's going to be fascinating to see how this plays out then. One of the things that also sort of came out of the reporting by Courthouse News was that in the gallery, or at least on the first day, there are a lot of folks in Stone clothing. Some employees, I think they said, some fans, and I'm guessing they probably rallied some folks to be there. Don't judges usually like shut that down if that's the case? Could that be prejudicial?
It could be. Because there's no reporting about it, I'm sure there was. That would have been some salacious reporting. So I'm sure nothing, the judge didn't comment on it at all. But if the audience is well-behaved and not shouting like Stone Forever or Cook Rocks or things like that, they're probably going to be okay. There are, you know, could be First Amendment concerns otherwise, which, you know, aren't absolute. There can be reasons when, you know, your right to free speech can be curtailed. But, you know, that's the type of thing that could go either way. I mean, depending on the jury panel. I mean, if you got a bunch of no-nonsense steel workers who just like to go home and have a cold Natty or Keystone Light, you know, you see a bunch of bearded white guys in the audience, you know, wearing fedoras and Stone shirts, that could have the opposite effect, you know? It really depends on the makeup of the jury, and who they elect as their foreperson can be a big factor as well.
One thing that I think is interesting here is, and Justin, you touched on this a little bit, is that Stone is bringing up how their sales have declined since the Keystone rebrand launched. And, you know, the sales are down 20%, $174 million, but a lot of other things happened in craft beer at that time too. Is that something that Molson Coors would want to bring up and say, like, hey, you're saying that we did this to you, but look, like, beer is losing share to spirits. The beer industry is in a 2-year pandemic that restricts the on-premise. Like, there's a lot more here than just our rebrand.
And they've definitely also brought up some of Stone's own falters, such as the Napa taproom closure and the Shanghai and Berlin facilities that closed or partnerships that ended.
Yeah, absolutely. So that doesn't go to liability, whether or not there's infringement. That goes to the damages portion of it. They're going to do everything they can to point out Stone's missteps and the craft decline of in the last couple of years generally. If I were them, I'd show just a graph, like overlay the graph, and maybe the percentages look relatively the same. They will look like the same thing happened to, you know, New Belgium or Sierra Nevada or any of their competitors. You know, if you could show the numbers going down generally, the jury's going to say, well, hey, like, yeah, everybody's going down. It's not based on this one can at a convenience store. It's based on just the general market forces.
So it sounds like that has to be like, it's a very particular scenario where Stone can actually like have a, what they would call a successful win on this. It's not just winning the case alone or the suit alone is going to be a victory. They have to get even further and have those damages paid for.
Yeah. If they win anything, I'm sure it'll be portrayed in the press as a victory. But if they win only that Keystone has to abandon its current branding and marketing campaigns where with a focus on Stone, they just go back to I mean, theoretically, they could just go back to whatever they were doing before the rebrand. If that was Stone's only victory, it'd probably be a pretty pyrrhic one, because they will have invested so much in this suit. I'm sure it won't sound pyrrhic in the press releases, but Stone, you know, has resources, but this is a pretty big sunk cost at this point, which is another reason it's less likely to settle.
Let's all just solve it right now and agree to a smaller Keystone Light font where it gets Key and Stone back together again, and we can all move on with our lives. But until we can move on with our lives, you willing to join us again to go over this as this trial progresses?
Yeah, absolutely. Happy to.
Well, look for Brendan to be back on the podcast in the coming weeks as this winds its way to a close. And with that, we'll say that's our show for this week. Thanks to our one-man audio team, Joe. Thanks for Brendan for hanging out. Thanks to Jess and Zoe. And thanks to all of you for listening. We'll be back next week.